either of you gentlemen remember Peggy Watton cookies?
You know, it was funny. You were talking about it in the chat earlier, and I didn't remember that name at all, but then I looked up the image, and I was like, oh my God, yeah, I'm pretty sure
iconic.
My grandmother had an endless supply of those things.
Yeah, right, right. Like, iconic. In fact, so they're a New England-based company. In fact, I just learned today that they were based in Walpole, Massachusetts, which is like the next town over from my hometown of Norwood. But Adam Schneider, former guest on this program, had he grew up in New Jersey, and he had fucking seen these Peggy Lawton cookies too. They were just like a scourge in like every elementary school a la carte fucking situation that you would get.
Well, I remember my mind was blown when I found out that my friend in Texas knew what Cape Cod potato chips were.
Oh man,
he's like, oh yeah, we get those down here. I was like, get the fuck out of here. Oh, I remember, yeah. Tom Ribeiro and I, former guests of the show, before we had phones that could tell you how to get places, we decided we wanted to go to the Cape Cod Chip Factory and get a factory tour. Mm. So instead of printing out MapQuest directions, we'd just stop at convenience stores and grab a bag and look at the map on the back of the bag. We wouldn't.
How close did you get?
We made it. We made it there, and I got to tell you, it was the most disappointing experience of my life. We like fucking, we're walking in, we're like so excited for the tour, gonna learn how chips are made. And we walk in, and there's this lady behind the counter, and we're like, we're here for the tour, and she's like, all right, yeah, it's down the hall right here. And it was literally like you walk down this hall, and there's
was it that woman from Monsters Inc? That's what you're sounding like.
It might as well have been.
Listen, I've been here for about 42 years. Yeah. I got about 4 months till retirement, and my pension's shitty. I've just been here peeling potatoes, and fuck you, kids.
And
now, will you light the cigarette in my stoma, please?
so we walk down the hall, and it's literally just like a 4x4 like glass window.
Yeah,
just looking out onto the factory floor, and you can't even see anything.
That's the tour.
That's the tour, and there's just a.
That's not a tour. That's a room.
And then there's a conveyor belt, and there's just a bunch of chips going by. And Tom and I are just like staring at it in silence, and you can just hear the low hum of the factory in the background. And then we're just like, all right. And then it dumped you into a gift shop, and that was it. I was like, wow, we spent a whole afternoon trying to find this fucking place, and this is what we got.
Just the low hum of the downtrodden proletariat of the potato chip factory.
And then,
yeah, no, did you salve that wound by buying merch?
No. We stole some free samples.
No, you were buying Cape Cod chips that's fucking day. They have plenty of your money.
That's not theft, by the way, if it's a free sample.
Yeah, well, it's free sample. We took samples, plural.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to call the cops over that one.
I'm still on the run, man. There's a warrant out for my arrest.
It's really funny you brought that up, because I actually have been to the Cape Cod factory as well, and in fact, it's one of my earliest memories. I want to say I was like 2 years old or some shit like that. But I was on my mom's back or whatever, or she was kind of like carrying me over her shoulder or whatever, and I remember a window into the factory.
And you were just screaming and crying and shitting your pants?
Probably.
I'm still really into the idea of Jim being wanted in Barnstable County. Like, just whenever like someone messes with you from now on, you could be like, you better watch yourself. I'm wanted in Barnstable County. Like that guy in the beginning of Star Wars.
You'll be dead.
Oh, so I should
You'll
just
be potato chipless.
So I should just call the Barnstable police then, and they'll come and arrest you. Thank you for telling me that.
Yes, the Barnstable County Sheriff has my number. He's coming for me.
Oh yeah, he's in his rocking chair, back in the Barnstable saloon. Just creaking back and forth, like, I'm going to get that Jimmy Schultz someday. Just know it.
Anytime I think of sheriffs, I think of, it's one of the first Ren and Stimpy episodes the evil sheriff of Dodge City, and he squirts him with gravy. Thou hast squirted me. It made me die.
Man, so I gotta come clean with you guys. I overdid it today. Did you have a Schultz dinner? I ate too many wings.
Oh, okay.
I ate too many wings. Yeah, no, I didn't do a Schultz dinner. That's something I don't think I will ever do.
No, too many wings. TMW. Fuck.
TMW. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, too much wings with that garlic parm sauce. That's just so fucking.
Well, I mean,
it was good.
You'll die for a worthy cause, which is a delicious wing.
Yeah, yeah. In pursuit of wings.
That's what we should all be doing.
Yeah, I just got to give a shout out to my local joint, Paisanos. That place is very, very good. It's no wings over, but it's the closest I've found anywhere to it.
Yeah, man, I haven't had wings over it's got to be at least 15 years now, and I always forget it's there.
Yeah, that's a fatal flaw, man. Although I guess it's a fatal flaw knowing that it's there as well, because I think if we lived in Somerville any longer than we did, I probably would have had a heart attack.
I wonder,
from the amount of wings that I got.
I wonder if they're if the quality differs from location to location, though, because I remember going to Providence when I was younger and them being like good, but I wasn't like blown away. But I also would get the tenders and not the wings themselves. So
the tenders are very good. So I have had it at Lowell, Alston, which is no longer there, and Somerville, and all three were pretty comparable.
Now, is this a New England establishment, or is there like a Wings Over Chicago, a Wings Over LA?
No, I think there's only like five. Yeah. They're mostly in Massachusetts. I think the original is in Amherst.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that being the original,
right.
Though.
Yeah, I remember Wings Over Amherst. That place was pretty legit. And then they opened up when I was still living in Alston. They had Wings Over Brookline, which was like literally right over
the
border.
Yeah, that's the one I meant. Yeah, Brookline.
Yeah.
Yep.
The one right over the border of fucking Alston and Brookline. If you just keep going up Harvard Ave. But that one was
damn, no. We are wrong. There are a lot of Wings Over.
Really?
Yeah, we have them in Connecticut, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Patrick,
ooh,
Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Tennessee, Vermont, and Wisconsin.
Wow.
Well, I'll be a cat's ass.
Yeah, huh?
Yeah, you will be a cat's ass. You better be a cat's ass. Now, we've just been fucking told.
The best wings I've ever had are at a place that no longer exists. It used to be a place called Wings and Things, and I remember it used to be in Riverside, Rhode Island, and they closed one day, and we thought they were gone for good. And Tom was driving with our friend Dennis, and all of a sudden he just yelled, "Stop!" Dennis like slammed on the brakes, and he looks over, and he's on like I think it's Brook Street in Providence, and it was there. They had moved to a new location and just didn't fucking tell anybody. So we would go there, but the owner was always mad, like all the time. He was just fucking mad about everything. I went in there one time, and he was like. And I was like, yeah, can I get it? He's like, let me tell you something. Never get married. Never, ever get married. People are not meant to be together for that long.
So he's mad about other shit. He's not mad about you getting wings. Okay, that's
good. Can I have a pound of...
You know. Can I have...
There was a restaurant that I remembered recently. There was a restaurant I remembered recently that was in Saugus growing up called Baker's Choice. And it was like a little hole-in-the-wall diner that's since been replaced by a little hole-in-the-wall Dunkin' Donuts. It was great, though. My dad used to take me there occasionally on Sundays, and it was like counter plus three tables. Like, that was like three tables that might sit two people each. It was like super, super small, but it was run by this Greek family. And the mother would work the counter, and the father and son, the grown son, would work in the kitchen. The problem was that the father and the son absolutely fucking hated each other.
Oh, yeah.
So you would hear screaming all the goddamn time. And like probably one out of every three or four times you heard the screaming start, you would see the son come out after a little while with a bloody nose, like holding it with like a rag.
Jesus Christ.
That's how you know the food's going to be good. You know,
well,
if they have a real row that day, that then you know the food's going to be extra.
They're
going
to take it out on the eggs, and those eggs are going to be the best you've ever had.
Well, I remember you telling us this story on Slack, and I had a similar experience with a place in Needham called Costa's, where it's run by a Greek family, and they're all just screaming at it. Like, they'll come to the counter and be like, "Hey, how you doing today? What can I get for you?" And then they turn around, and they're like, "Fucking John, what the fuck are you doing? Get out!" Like, and they're just fucking screaming at each other.
Yeah, I did some contract work once for like a handyman type company, And I was working for this couple in Winchester that were great because they were the nicest people when they were talking to you. So, like, we'd be, like, in there painting, and they'd come out, and they'd be like, hey, can we get you guys a drink or anything? Like, you know, is it too warm, too hot in here, too cold? You know, we can adjust temperature, whatever you want. Like, no, that's good. All right, no problem. Go out into the other room. And then, like, the wife will just be like, Dan, get in here! And like, the husband walks in. He's like, what the hell is this shit? What is this shit? We gotta talk about this! And then, like, after a little while of screaming, the husband would walk back in, and he'd just be like, oh, hey, guys, can I get you anything? Has the missus offered you anything yet?
Just like a switch that flips.
It was a switch. Like, basically, if they were in the same room together, they would be screaming. But the second they were apart, they were, like, the nicest people.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I would take that over, like, you know, the sort of English and Irish way of stuffing your feelings down forever until you just explode one day or just drink them, your feelings away someday. I'd rather just have that explosion right then and there than come back out and be like, yeah, so what do you want to do for dinner, honey? So we're here to talk about an album. We do that sometimes. We've been doing this since like 2017. God damn.
Really? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yep.
I actually threw on our very first episode the other day, and it's kind of crazy how like the format was slightly different. But we were all still there. We were so young.
How much we've evolved and haven't evolved at the same time.
we've all matured into fine wines.
Devolve. Yeah. Anyway, we are on the 86th episode at this point, and we are here this evening to talk about Signals, Calls, and Marches, which was originally an EP and the debut release from American post-punk band Mission of Burma, who also hail from our hometown of Boston. But tonight we actually listened... Fucking kid. But this evening we actually listened to the 2008 Matador Records release track listing, the 10-track listing of the... albums, so I guess it's more of an LP situation. I don't know, but anyway, it's debut release from these guys, released way back in 1981 by the record label Ace of Hearts, and then also eventually Matador Records, of course. But yeah, not really a ton of information here on the album. Upon its release in 1981, the record was immediately popular in the Boston area, charting at number 6 on local radio station WBCN. And the EP sold out of its initial pressing of 10,000 copies before the end of the year. And then it was re-released on Ryko Disc at some point, and then included a couple more songs, Academy Fight Song and Max Ernst, and then eventually they did the 10th song, Who Wacky, in 2008. Reception. In his retrospective review, Mark Deming of AllMusic.com stated that if Mission of Burma were not yet at the peak of their form, most bands blazing as many trails as this one did lost their footing a lot more often than Burma did on these 6 songs. But Signals, Calls, and Marches was an accomplished and impressive a debut as any American band could release in the 80s. It kind of has a legacy of, you know, obviously it was more of a indie rock release at the time in little old Boston. But it had an effect on... groups that would kind of come later on in the decade, the sort of breaking between hardcore punk and like indie rock, I guess, indie college rock, and it's considered like an immensely influential landmark in the field of indie rock and alternative rock, had a huge influence on rock bands like REM, Fugazi, Nirvana, and kind of hear little elements of that all over this album, but they also kind of have their own thing going, where they have this guy Martin Swope, who comes in and does loops over the whole thing, which is kind of a, you know, not common thing to see in a punk band at this time. So they definitely made an impression in a live setting.
I'd make the argument that they were more post-punk than punk.
Yeah, definitely.
They experimented quite a bit with song structure. They had solos. They had noise solos. They had songs that were over 3 minutes. Like, I think that they were definitely starting to experiment with the form a bit. And that's honestly why one of the reasons that I like them so much. Because standard punk is fine, you got to do something to like really get my attention. Like McCluskey is a great example of that because they've just got that real snark, and it seems like all of their songs are about just like shitty people from their shitty town, and that's just endearing to me, and I really enjoy that. And Burma's got that experimental edge about them,
yeah.
And constantly having someone on a tape machine is definitely a good way to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, I mean, I would even go as far as to say it's like a seminal post-punk album, like, you know, kind of one of the, you know, on the vanguard of that genre. So, you know, in their early live shows, Mission of Burma was kind of characterized by a lot of noise and chaos. But this record notes a kind of more cleaner sound, I guess, production-wise than their live performances kind of indicate. And like, there are some people who said this was a bit misrepresentative of the sound. But I don't know. I think it also gives the album a lot of character and kind of sets it apart from other, you know, noisier punk bands, is they're kind of using clean guitars. In fact, I was just listening on, just noticing on this past listen how much acoustic guitar was used on the album. I never really noticed that before. But
yeah, it's a bunch.
But yeah, I always thought that was kind of a cool production technique that, who was it, Richard W. Hart did on this album. So yeah, not really a ton more to say on this.
Man, I gotta say, you mentioned Fugazi, and it just reminded me that Fugazi is one of those names that I've heard basically my entire life, and I have never heard a single Fugazi song. I don't know how the hell that happens, but
they're okay. They got a few decent songs.
I feel like when I went to school, it was like, you know, all the indie kids were like, "Do you listen to Fugazi?" It's like, no.
Yeah, so like Fugazi is they're
more like post-hardcore.
They're like, yeah, they're post-hardcore, and they got a lot of notoriety for their like DIY aesthetic and like, you know, $6 shows or whatever the fuck they would put on.
Yeah, just Ian McKay mentality.
Ah, that's what I was gonna say. Okay, that's so my friend Ed, who lives in DC, got to interview him.
Yeah, Ian McKay, guy Picciotto.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ian McKay is coming off of Minor Threat, who had a very similar sort of situation right, going
okay.
on there.
That's all coming together now.
Yeah, their album, Fugazi's album, In on the Killtaker, is pretty good. I actually own that one on vinyl.
They had I liked whatever their like first big release was, the one with Waiting Room on it, whatever the fuck that was called. 13
was that
songs.
Repeater?
13 songs, I think, or maybe Repeater. Actually, that one's pretty good too. And then they did like another song in the either late 90s or early 2000s that I really liked. I can't fucking remember the name of it, but I remember downloading it off of that old LimeWire machine that you'd have.
Ian McKay also did a two-track side project that put out a record, and they were called Egg Hunt, which is a great name for a band. But what surpassed the name of the band was the cover.
Oh, yes.
Which was a clear picture of a shower, and you could see the ceiling above it, and there was a tile missing, and Ian McKay was just poking his face through and smiling.
Oh, it's very good. Yeah, I'm a...
It's so good. And the two tracks are actually pretty good, too.
Excellent. So let's go around the old Hordeski and talk about favorite songs off of Signals, Calls, and Marches. And let's start with Jimmy Boy this time. Jim.
Jim Boy. My favorite track, I'm gonna preface all of this with this album really didn't grab me too much, so bear with me here. I'm gonna go with Outlaw. My favorite track. I felt like that one kind of had a that one had a kind of a Talking Heads vibe to it, and I do love the Talking Heads, so that one kind of kind of stuck out to me. I just felt like that guitar part was very kind of jarring and unique and kind of was like it perked my ears up. I was like, okay, because I felt like for the first four songs on this album, I was like, all right, this is just kind of like this kind of samey. But then once it gets further along in the album, like you mentioned, they're kind of doing some experimental stuff, and that kind of grabbed my attention a little more, or at least, you know, maybe they were doing shit in the first four tracks, but it wasn't really grabbing me yet. But by the time we hit the song, I was like, all right, this is starting to like kind of be cool, and I guess I'll pay attention now.
I always heard Gang of Four in that song, and to me, Gang of Four and Mission of Burma are like inextricably linked in my brain.
Oh yeah, big time. I heard it was that one or Execution that I said it sounded like had like big early Incesticide era Nirvana on there too. Like that was the one that I was hearing a lot of Nirvana, not Nirvana mm-hmm. influence, but the influence that they would have on that band.
Yeah.
Christopher, what about you?
Well, I know what you're going to pick, and what you're going to pick is going to be the correct thing. So in the interest of being not too boring here, I'm going to go with my second favorite, which is another obvious pick, which is That's When I Reach for My Revolver.
Well, duh.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a fucking good song. It's timeless.
That would have been my other pick. I was going to pick that one until Outlaw came on.
Yeah, and it's insane to me to think that, like, just a bunch of, like a few fuck-ups from Boston, like, not much different from us, like, put out a song that fucking good when they were, you know, I don't know, being charitable, like, 13 years younger than us at the time. So,
oh, yeah.
Like, things like that blow my mind when I hear something that's that fucking good and that fucking resonant, and it was done by someone younger than me. Like, that, it's insane. But, yeah, it's a great song. A little weird in this day and age to listen to, but, no, it's a great song. It's timeless,
yeah,
and
just,
it's one of my favorites of all time.
Just for the listeners out there, just so we can paint a picture for you, the three of us are a couple of washed up old farts who are probably not going to amount to anything musically in our lives. So
yeah
it's definitely. Yeah.
Hey, I'll have you know, I had a video that went viral that contained no original content of my own.
Christopher's the most famous out of all of us.
That's true. He's done
yes,
the most.
Yes, and again, I must stress that it was through no original content of my own.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great song, and that's one that's sung by Clint Conley. There's three songs, I guess. I know that he writes three of them, so I'm going to assume that he sings lead on those ones.
I like that you guys liked my drawing. I guess I got a good cackle out of the both of you. That's good.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
That was a good caricature.
Yeah, it made me laugh almost as hard as that picture Jim Patrick sent me of a sad Jim Morrison's dad.
Which was like the following video after a whatever the
Goofy Gophers,
the Goofy
from, Looney
Gophers
Tunes.
From Looney Tunes would get together and thank each other. And the next video was Jim Morrison's dad and sister open up about Jim Morrison's death. It's just like a very like red eyed sad old man being.
Well, it's very related, of course.
Right. Yeah.
The death of Jim Morrison is directly tied to the Goofy Gophers from Looney Tunes.
I heard he looked up to them. To be honest.
So. Yeah, he was always.
Yeah, most of Morrison Hotel was written about them.
Yeah. He was always thanking people and expecting people to thank him back. No, thank you. He would always be doing that.
Yeah, Jim Morrison was nothing if not polite.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Big time. Big into manners. Yeah, so, that's when I reach for my revolver is a really fucking great song. It's a, I would say it's up there with, like, a Radio Free Europe or whatever Husker Du did for tunes. it's a post-punk classic, definitely. And it's pretty cool that it came out of, Boston. So I would probably pick Revolver as my favorite, but
oh, really?
I would have, but no, I actually, on this listen, I am going to go with Academy Fight Song. Which, oddly, that wasn't on the original six-song EP, which surprises me. I think it's a supremely strong track from them. Melodically and like, kind of what they're doing with the chord progressions, it's, yeah, kind of one of the more interesting, dangerous progressions that they do, I guess. It does a lot of things in, you know, 3 minutes and 9 seconds. It's just like a really strong kind of poppy punk song. And, you know,
it's a hell of a mission statement as an opener, even though it's not the intended opener.
Yeah, it really works for me. Like, this 2008 listening is kind of the canon one in my head. It's the one that I didn't really start getting into them until, you know, after 2011 sometime. But, I just always thought that was a super strong opener. For a punk song, it has this, like, kind of, I don't know, something about the progression is, like, it has a sort of, like, melancholy to it, but it's also, like, very upbeat, so it's, like, a kind of cool disconnect. It's something that I get out of, like, dumb example would be Everlong by the Foo Fighters, where it's, like, very upbeat, but, but, like, something is just kind of, like, you know, sad about it, I guess. It's just like good production, that classic fucking college rock snare drum, dead as fuck. Yeah. I don't know. I'll get into my rest of my thoughts later. Jim, what was your least favorite track?
Oh, my least favorite track. I'm going to go with This Is Not a Photograph. I don't have really much to say about it other than I didn't like that they just kept repeating that. And other than that, there's really nothing that kind of stuck out to me, and I'm just picking that one as my least favorite.
Good stuff.
Hey, so it's probably a good time to tell a story about seeing Mission of Burma live in 2012, early 2012. All right. I saw them at Brighton Music Hall, and I was with Danielle. We had just started dating. And we were with our friend Xander. And Xander, I don't know if I've mentioned him on this podcast before. He's a good dude. Comes from New Orleans. He moved up here briefly. We worked with him. And then he ended up moving back to NOLA. He's a low-level lunatic. He's awesome. He's exactly the kind of person that you want to hang out with on a Friday or Saturday night if you want to have an absolutely insane night that you will probably survive. So Xander was really into punk. So I introduced him to Mission to Burma, and the show happened to be scheduled not too long after I introduced him to Burma. So he's like, "Ah, dude, we got to go to this." I'm like, "All right, yeah, it sounds good." So the three of us go, and something about Xander. We discovered after a while, I think it was Owen that made this observation, that if a group of people ever went out with Xander at night, one of the people that was not Xander would black out. That was just a casualty of the evening. It would be Danielle in this particular circumstance. But Xander's philosophy towards indoor shows was that All indoor shows are smoking as long as you only take a couple puffs of the cigarette. So we were standing there watching Mission of Burma, and he takes out a cigarette, lights it up, takes a couple puffs, then drops it on the floor and stomps it out. And I look at him, I'm like, what the fuck, dude? And he's like, oh, no, that's cool. I just take a couple puffs. It's not a problem. So he did this like two or three times, and every time I was like, really wary of like, what the fuck? Like, we're going to get thrown out of here. And finally, on like the third time, I looked back a little bit and realized we were standing directly in front of Abe and his dad. And neither of them really looked impressed by Xander.
Why not? Why
Let's
not?
Hang out
he's
with
now
Xander.
A dad. And he's now a dad and makes kick-ass looking pizzas.
Oh, that dude. Okay.
Yeah. He's the pizza guy.
Zanderman. The pizza
man.
I got
to tell you guys a story that just popped into my head that Emily told me on Mother's Day. The day after Mother's Day. So my parents came over on Sunday. When does this shit drop? The 15th?
Yeah.
Whatever the day fuck Monday, Mother's Day was. So my parents came over and Emily was coming home from a bachelorette party thing. And she stopped at her parents' house to see her mom, and on Monday after Mother's Day, I was like, "Oh, how was your parents? I forgot to ask you." And you guys have met my future father-in-law and know
oh,
how
yes.
nuts he is.
He's a wonderful and at times terrifying man.
Well, he went to an estate sale.
this is a good setup already.
And so Emily's like, yeah, I get to my parents' house, and my dad's just like, all right, you got to see what I got from this estate sale. And he's got all this fucking crap that he bought from an estate sale. Apparently, he found an unopened bottle of whiskey from like the 1960s, and I was like, oh, I want to know what that is, because that might actually be like worth a damn. But that's not the best part. The best part was that John was at this estate sale, and he saw a garden, and there was a snake in the garden, and he took the snake, and he brought it home.
The snake was not for sale. What the hell, dude?
Well, he didn't pay for it. He took it.
And his logic was, well, I want the snake in my garden to eat the stuff that's not supposed to be in the garden, like rodents and stuff. And he's like, he pulled it out of the trunk. He's like, here, look at this. Like, shoved it in Emily's face.
So we did the 48-hour film festival this past weekend, or film project, whatever. Me, Danielle, Deegan, former guest of the show, and other former guest of the show, Matt Keezer. So we were on a Zoom call on Friday night doing a kickoff. And we ended up talking about like potentially getting John for the voice that you, Jim, ultimately did.
I actually thought about that too. While I was doing it, I was like, I should really just have John do this.
Yeah. So we were trying to describe to Matt and Deegan, because Deegan didn't actually meet him. They didn't cross
paths.
That's
right.
Yeah. So we were trying to describe him. And I was just like, oh, I'll just describe Grant's reaction to him, which was being absolutely terrified of acting with him.
That is incredible.
Patrick, was it with you when we were jamming in the barn and he just came upstairs and started singing like Highway Star as we were playing
yes.
something else?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that was during a smell practice, yeah.
I remember him.
Yeah, we
at
were
a barbecue.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we were playing Yeoman Child, and he thought we were playing Highway Star, and he came up and started just singing Deep Purple's
Amazing.
Highway Star.
So yeah, Boric was very happy about that.
So it was at a barbecue at your old place where I think he got a little high. And
that sounds about right.
He was sitting in a lawn chair with his head all the way back, and he just kept saying to himself, "Far enough for." Great album.
What is it? What album?
Foreigner 4. Great album.
Oh, Foreigner number 4.
Foreigner 4, yeah.
Which is, I think that's the one with, I think that's the one like the first one from the 80s or the second one. Foreigner 4. Oh, yeah, the one with the clock on it from 1981. It's got Urgent, Waiting for a Girl Like
You. It's got
you.
Like the film countdown on the cover.
Oh, yeah. Jukebox Hero. Oh yeah, this is a great album. Fuck yeah.
Great album.
Yeah, it does have some bangers on it. Great album. Four on a four. Yeah, I really love Waiting for a Girl Like You because back in the days of GTA Vice City, that was always my favorite song to have playing on the radio when I was in a police chase.
Oh, yeah, that's fucking gorgeous song, actually. Not going to lie.
Yeah, it's just great when there's like helicopters shooting at you and you're like flooring it.
You know, I know two guys who dropped out of high school to play GTA 4 together.
Wait, what? That's not a career path.
No, it's not.
Okay. I tried to tell
them that. But the saddest part is they don't even talk to each other anymore.
Oh, man. The dream is over.
Yeah.
That is really sad. That's really sad. Christopher, what was your least favorite track?
My least favorite is exactly that. Least favorite, it is Fame and Fortune. I like it just fine. I think that the rest of the songs on this album just have a lot more to bring to the table than this one. But yeah, no problems with it. It's just the others are better.
Oh yeah, I honestly can't even remember that one off the top of my head. I think I liked it though. No, I like that one. My least favorite is it was a toss up between This Is Not a Photograph and Execution. And I'm going to go with Execution. It wasn't complicated with the time wrong. He kept it to run, but it took him too long because he had it in his arms. Then he just couldn't see the men behind him. Just because it's a little bit longer. Both of those tracks kind of did the same thing for me, which is a little too punky. And my note here is I'm Baby. I don't know. Just, a little too punky, not enough post-punk for me. I can't really put it any other way. Just doesn't crank my hog.
doesn't blow up your scrote.
It does not blow up my scrote. It does not unendanger my manatee. That's a previously unsaid sentence.
Hey, funny! Let this crank your hog.
Oh God, Roger, come on! This is a family program.
I wonder what he's up to.
That's when
these
I reach
days.
For my revolver. More like that's when I reach for my hog.
So, given what we know about Roger Klotz, what do you think he's doing now at probably the age of 40, 50?
Well, let's say
he's probably 40.
I would say he was 13 years old in like 1992 or something. When
Doug first aired, I was Doug's age.
They
and
were
Roger
in
was a couple
grade.
Years older. Yeah, Roger was a couple years older.
Oh, really?
Oh no, wait, no, they.
No, I thought they were in the same grade.
No, Doug was older than me, but no, Roger stayed back.
Okay.
They mentioned that at one point.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I guess Doug was older than me then.
Yeah. So, yeah, so we can reasonably assume he's probably now in his mid-40s. Mid-40s, mid to late 40s, or something like that.
Yeah, I would...
He's got at least one illegitimate child.
Probably has a glue issue. Like, huffing glue.
Yeah. Yeah, probably works down at the Sunoco station in the convenience store, and he plays a lot of grunge, and he likes to ask me questions about his favorite Alice in Chains song when I'm just there to buy my fruit snacks and vanilla wafers.
Somehow, somehow he's married to Patty Mayonnaise now because Patty actually got married, not to Doug, but to somebody else, but then got divorced and now is married to Roger Klotz.
Yeah, Roger's a rebound marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, funny, it's a living.
Hey, funny. What's
hey, funny. Hey, funny. You ever wonder if my hog's green too?
Oh, hey, funny. Does yours smell funny too? Huh? Mine does.
Hey, hey, funny. Does yours smell funny? Funny? Hey, funny. My carpets match the drapes. Funny?
Funny, check out that new Beats album. Masturbation.
I'm really glad that Roger Klotz is now in play.
God.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a great, timeless character. Who didn't know a Roger? Who wasn't, you know, romantically involved with a Roger in their, not romantically.
Yeah, I wasn't romantically involved with him, but my buddy Christian was the Roger at my school.
the Roger at my school actually was named Roger.
Oh, amazing.
The Roger at our school chopped off his finger in woodshop class, I remember, in 10th grade.
Hey, Barry, I don't have a finger.
Hey, Barry, watch this. Oh, that was fucking stupid.
Hey, Barry, high nine.
We had a Beavis and Butthead, too. I don't remember what their names were, but it was like...
That's very good.
we had a Beavis that was a couple years older than me. He actually had like a ridiculous underbite too. It was just really good.
Like what?
I love the line. We had a Beavis. It's like a movie. It's like we bought a zoo.
We bought a Beavis.
we bought a Beavis.
So I love it. So like the Beavis and Butthead sort of dichotomy, like that implies that there was like a more intelligent one, because like Butthead was the smarter one, right?
Yeah.
Or something like
that. He was marginally smarter. I don't even know if he's necessarily smarter, as if that he can communicate better.
The thing is, he communicate better. He was slightly more confident, yeah. I guess, in his knowledge of things, which is half the battle, really. All right, so we're moving on to the MVP segment of this program. Jim, what was your MVP moment?
I'm still thinking about We Bought a Beef. The feel-good movie of the summer.
It's always great when the episode title is obvious.
Yeah, I'm already writing that down.
My MVP moment is going to be in red. I guess it would be the bridge part.
That movie fucking stuck so bad. We bought a zoo. We watched it a few weeks ago. We had to turn it off. It fucking sucked. Dude, Cameron Crowe directed that?
Oh, my
God.
Good God.
What a
yeah,
fucking...
Yeah, Yonsi did the score for whatever reason.
Good God. Okay, Jim, I'm so sorry. You're MVP moment, Eric.
No, it's all right. We're having a good time talking about Beavis's. Or Bevi is the plural, I believe.
No, we have to take it back. We have a responsibility to uphold here.
Yes. So my MVP moment, I think it's the bridge. This cool bass part comes in, and then the guitar starts kind of following it, and then there's some oohs happening over it. I thought that section was pretty cool.
Song was that again?
Yeah, that was
on red.
That was red.
Oh yeah. That, good shit.
That was a runner up for my MVP too. That's a really, really fucking fun little part with all the just random tape noises that are happening, and the guitar is like kind of soloing and kind of just saying fuck it and like doing like Tom Morello things.
Yeah, it's a nice kind of like 11th hour thing to throw in there, like, you know, second to last track. Sick. Christopher, what was your MVP moment?
Mine are going to be the instrumental pre-choruses in Max Ernst. And I love those bits because they basically sound like the band is completely losing it and not holding it together whatsoever. But they hold it together. And it's definitely intentionally done that way, but it just kind of sounds like the musical equivalent of falling downstairs. And I love it.
Yes. Well, Max Ernst, of course, was the progenitor of the Dadaism, which is...
Hence the Dada backing vocals at the end.
Yes, exactly, which is like the art movement of silliness. Like, let's just get silly and real fucking silly. I don't think that's it.
Hey, but. Funny, let's get silly.
Hey, funny.
With your ass.
Hey, funny, you into Dadaism? I'm your Dada.
I like the idea of Roger talking about intellectual things.
Yeah. Hey, you into Tristan Cesara? And Francis Pickham.
Hey, funny, what do you think the significance of known existentialist Albert Camus becoming a Christian before he died was?
Well, geez, I don't know, Roger. I better, Douglas, let me just show my this buddy here, Douglas.
Oh, nice. Mr. Dink is here.
Oh, yeah. Douglas. Let me see your
Mr. Dink. Doug. Honk, honk.
Mr. Dink was definitely the guy who would jerk off in his backyard.
Oh, definitely. Right. With a name like kid, that.
Yeah.
Well, good evening, Douglas. As you can see, I've got my hands full.
Fucking song that would play whenever he went over his house.
I remember Tom and I were talking about... We were talking about Doug one time, and he was like, that whole show can be summed up in one word. Honk.
There's a lot of honking that happens on that show.
Hey, Doug! Honk, honk!
Yeah, even like the score is just, it's like beatboxing and like with the occasional honking.
Yep.
Man, I want to watch some Doug after this.
I think I'm going to watch
Let's hurry up and finish recording this right. So I can watch some Doug and imitate everyone on it.
All right, yes. Let's move through.
Your MVP.
My MVP. I had a couple, actually. And I'll go with the one that I'm not going to go with first, which is the vocal harmony at the end of the last chorus of That's When I Reach for My Revolver is just like... It's so fucking like... poppy, like it's like the perfect fucking harmony. It's like, what, like they shouldn't know how to like lay that harmony on top. These guys are too fucking young and stupid to know for it to be that good, but they did. Yeah. it's fucking great. It's what like kicks that song like out of the punk category and into the post-punk category for me, along with a lot of other things, but I'm actually gonna go with the sort of like, I don't know if they're choruses or bridges in Devotion. The I should have known better than it kind of switches to this like it modulates to this chord progression, and it's just fucking fierce. And like these doing these like kind of, I don't know if it's a like a sort of like harmonization between the guitar and bass or what, but there's like kind of this like ninth quality that happens there, and it just really, it's a great dissonance that happens on there. And It's not like punk dissonance, it's like jazz dissonance, so it really kind of has this cool quality on top of like the very post-punky aesthetic. I should have known better than to feed so greedy from this filthy hand. It's the same old story beyond the side. Yeah, it's just kind of like an unexpected part.
It's not surprising. Because Roger Miller is actually a trained pianist as well, going into Mission of Burma, so he probably had some thoughts on harmony and whatnot going into it.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah, that song's funny to me because Conley's vocals in it remind me of Scott Weiland so much.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, a little bit. It's like he was trying to do the Johnny Rotten thing, but yeah, it ended up sounding a lot more palatable than that.
God. Yeah, because he's not affecting like a fake fucking accent to do it like fucking Johnny Rotten. Oh, the Sex Pistols suck.
Worst.
Johnny Rotten is like mostly a really shitty person too, except for the fact that he's been a good husband to his wife.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, she's like super sick or something, and he's like basically retreated from the public eye just to take care of her.
He's a very confounding figure in music. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. So we did all the MVPs. Let's compare this fucker. Jim, what was your comparable recall?
All right, as you guys know, I'm not much of a punky, I'll call myself here. I'm a proggy boy. But I mentioned I heard a little bit of Talking Heads on this. I also heard a little bit of Sonic Youth. I'm going to go with Sonic Youth's Daydream Nation.
Ooh. That was one of my picks, too. But I had a few. That's great. I was thinking the same thing, just because production-wise, it's like very similar. That snare drum is in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the production from this kind of helped inform like the warmth of those kind of mid-era Sonic Youth records. Christopher.
I'm probably going to take another one of your picks, and I am going to go with Gang of Four's 1979 album Entertainment. Like I mentioned earlier, I find these two bands to be two sides of the same coin. You know, we basically just have the English and American versions of a band. And Gang of Four is a bit more jagged and a bit more dancey at times, but I think that Burma is weirder and at times more enjoyable. But they're two bands that I really love, and I really love similar things about them. So they're just linked in my head.
Yeah, and I would say that Gang of Four was like slightly more political too. Not that Signals, Colors, and Marches.
Oh, they were. Gang of Four was very political.
Yeah, they were like very on like bold faced political. Where, you know, Signals, Colors, and Marches is more like, kind of like esoteric and weird.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're hardcore leftists. Gang of Four.
Those two records were kind of what I had in my head as well. So I'm going to go with the third one that I thought of, which is REM's debut, Murmur. Kind of like not exactly the same, but like kind of similar in the sense where like they definitely have it's a early record of theirs and kind of like an early seminal example of post-punk. But REM is like a little... They kind of like click one step further towards alternative rock and kind of like one step away from their punk roots. But both bands kind of have a, you know, they're from the indie DIY punk scene and, you know, obviously have a lot of kind of holdings in those scenes. And also just like production wise, both very, warm snare drum, you know, very 80s college rock production, jangly guitars, and all that good shit. Like I said, just that's when I reached for my revolver and Radio Free Europe, kind of both comparable songs in that era.
Yeah, and on REM's first tours, they used to cover Academy Fight Song a lot of the time, so they were obviously influenced by Burma.
Yeah, big time. Word. All right.
So Paul from Very Lumar got really into Burma a few years ago. He hadn't really heard them before. And I think I played them for him or something, whatever. But he got into them at some point in like 2014, 2015. It was 2015. Because they were opening for Foo Fighters at Fenway.
Along with
the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
Yeah.
So I was going to that show just because I've never been to a show at Fenway, and I'm like, you know, Foo Fighters would be a fun show to do there. Like, that's going to be a fun one. They're playing with the Boss Tones, and Mission of Burma is there. Like, this is going to be a fun thing to do. So Paul got tickets for it because he wanted to see Mission of Burma. Now, bear in mind, this is 2015, not now when Mission of Burma has permanently broken up again. So he spent like $75 a head for him and his then fiance to go to a concert to see a band that if he had waited like 3 months, he could have seen at Brighton Music Hall for $15.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's right.
And like at Fenway, they played like six or seven songs. Like that was it. And then they were done.
Oh, my God. So I actually mentioned this in our chat. I saw Mission of Burma before I even knew who the fuck they were. It was when they had just reformed in 2004, and they opened for the Pixies at this is at the Songus Arena in Lowell. And I'm kicking myself for, like, you know, not having much memory of the set other than just being like, oh, this is kind of a cool, noisy indie rock band. I'm like,
yeah,
it's fucking Mission of Burma, of course. I'm glad I got to see them, but, like, you know, was too much of a fucking idiot to know who they were.
Listening to this album, I can definitely see how they're probably more of a live act to see.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. One of the notes on the wiki here is like there was sort of confusion with people who bought this album, and it was like, you know, had this sort of clean production to it, and then they would go to the show and they're way noisier live than they are on this album. So there was like a little bit of confusion between the fans there.
Yeah, Roger Miller was talking about how before one of their shows in some city, a girl went up to him outside and said that "That's When I Reached My Revolver" is one of her favorite songs. And he was like, oh, that's great. And she's like, yeah, me and all my friends are here to see you. This is going to be awesome. Apparently, they started playing the first song, and everyone in the venue, like, pressed themselves against the back of the venue because it was so loud. And he was like, yeah, and, like, even though we started, like, taunting them and everything, they didn't move. They just stayed far away from us.
All right. Like, I guess let's rate this now. Jim, what do you rate Signals, Calls, and or Marches?
Okay. So as I mentioned, this album really didn't grab me. But it's interesting because the more I listen to you guys talk about it, the more I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I heard that and I heard that. And, you know, it might require a few more listens from me that, to be 100% honest with you, I'm not going to do. but I was originally going to give this a 5, and as the album progressed, I was like, all right, I am noticing some of the more experimental things that you guys pointed out. So with that, I will give it a middle-of-the-road 6. Not my cup of tea. I didn't hate it. I can see how, you know, this would be something that people would enjoy, but it's just not something that I'm going to go out of my way to listen to. So a 6.
Cool. Christoforo.
This basically has everything I want from a post-punk album. It's not at, like, Joy Division levels for me, but it is really high up there. So this is getting a very soft 10.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, this album is fucking awesome. I love this album. I own it on vinyl. I listen to it often. It's a fucking great album.
So does your vinyl have all 10 songs on it?
Sure does.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that is really the canon release, and like, you know, I'm all for, you know, trimming the fat or whatever, but like, honestly, this 10 song sends make a fucking pretty good album and a pretty good, like, representation of what these guys do best.
Yeah, although it's weird because they put the bonus songs at the end, which is what you would normally expect.
Right.
So it opens with "That's When I Reach for My Revolver," which is odd. So it's odd hearing that track list, but, you know, I don't care. All the songs are there. Yeah. I really like the album, so it does not matter to me.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all going down. I think, like, it's weird. Like, I'm not a huge punk guy, but, like, this is one of those albums, kind of like Daydream Nation and even like Tim from The Replacements. That kind of helped me understand punk a little more. Even though it's, like, technically in the post-punk camp, it kind of helped me understand that aesthetic, I guess, a lot more. And I can appreciate where it's being used, but, like, at the same time, these guys can, you know, they could definitely put together a song. And, you know, for me, like, all the, you know, experimentation, noise, you know, funky sounds put together, like, doesn't really mean shit if you can't, like, write a song. And, like, really the other way around, if you can't make your instrumentation sound interesting, like, it doesn't really matter if you can write a song. So it kind of works both ways for me. That being said, I'm going to give it a soft 9. It is not like something that it had a huge influence on me, but I love it every time I put it on. I get it. I get people's excitement about it. And it, like I said, it's one of those kind of rare punk albums that helps me appreciate the genre a lot more. Because just what the level of care that these guys put into like melodies and like songcraft on top of, you know, esoterics and making it, you know, a discordant post-punk album, really. So yeah, there's like just that kind of melodic sweetness that goes over the whole thing, and a general nice warmth production-wise that happens that places it nicely amongst other equal albums of that generation, and like, and it's cool that it's from Boston, so it's something that we can be proud of. All right. Cool. So that's
you gonna give that? Did you actually give it a number or?
Yeah, I gave it 9.
A soft 9.
Soft 9.
Yeah. All right.
Gives us an 8-point repeating 3.
All right. All right. That repeating 3 is important. All right, well, that's all the segments. Do you guys have things for me? I don't think it's really appropriate to guess the net worth of Clinton Connolly since we're
I looked it up. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I would feel weird doing that since I am Facebook friends with him.
I'm sure he's doing just fine. all right. All right, cool. Let's
I saw
wrap this
he
up.
Actually he quit music for a while and worked for fucking Chronicle.
Yeah, I saw that too.
yeah, he what is he, got into like music journalism or something for a while?
Tonight on Chronicle.
Oh, that
covered
Chronicle,
bridges.
Right. Oh, actual
yeah,
journalism.
Yeah, it's
real. The real
stuff.
As,
how Boston is that? Yeah, kid, for a few years I was in fucking Mission to Burma, then I worked on Chronicle, then I got back with fucking Burma, kid.
Now I'm just home looking after my daughter. She's a good kid.
Pfft. Let's get some fucking dunks.
All right, I guess we're all going to go watch Doug now, so let's wrap this up. Anything, Jim, you want to plug anything?
My website's almost done. I actually fucking sat down and like worked on it. I got a couple of things I got to tweak, and then I'll launch that, and I'll actually finally have a website that I've been talking about building for the last 20 years and haven't done. Other than that, no, I think we're getting ready to wrap up tracking vocals for the new Cactus Attack record, and then I'll be mixing that and we'll drop that, and that's about it from the gym camp.
Ooh, yeah. Christopher?
Like I said, we just did the 48-hour film project. So we have a short film entitled The Johnson Report that is not available as of this release, but it will be available as of, let me look at the calendar here. It will be available as of Sunday the 16th, the evening of Sunday the 16th on the Hans Barrera YouTube channel. So be sure to check that out.
Excellent. Excellent. And I won't plug anything this time around. That's fine. Okay. Well, that's a episode of Old Men Yellow Cloud. Thanks again for joining us. Be sure to check out all the other shows on the Zero Science Network, like Jukebox Zeros, which I am also a part of. And, you know, Clamshell Case Files, Hell is a Musical, you know, and all the rest that I can't remember off the top of my head. World of Commotion and all that good stuff.
And Stevie's Hot Dog Cast.
Stevie's Hot Dog Castle. you know.
It's a cast, but castle is better.
Devon's chicken arrangement. And
see, here's the arrangement. I buy the chicken from the store, then I fuck it.
Oh, goodness. I didn't approve that. What the hell? Who let this guy on our network?
Yeah, as I got older, speaking
I came in with Roger.
We were speaking of We were talking about Ren and Stimpy and how deranged it is. And as I got older, like looking back at some of the episodes and like kind of putting two and two together, the episode where Stimpy falls in love with the goddamn raw chicken.
That's where you develop that fetish. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us. This is Patrick.
Well, I'm Christopher.
This is Jim. We will see you in hell.
And don't forget, funny.
We bought a Beavis.
Science.
Hello, my name's Christopher. I'm something of a movie fanatic.
Hi, my name is Patrick, and I have a very short attention span.
In Must Watch Movies, a new podcast from the Zero Science Podcast Network, I'm going to try to put some culture into Patrick's trash brain.
In each installment, Christopher will choose a critically acclaimed film for me and my guest to watch for the very first time.
I'll open up each episode with why I selected the film in question, and what I hope Patrick and his guests will get out of it.
Meanwhile, my guests and I will attempt to give an objective take on a film that's been revered by many for years and years. So grab some popcorn and snuggle up on the couch while you listen to a Philistine stumble his way through some of the greatest works put to celluloid.
Coming in May, be sure to check out Must Watch Movies on the Zero Science Podcast Network, or wherever you download podcasts.
Ugh, damn it, I burned the popcorn.